This is Dave Gahary reporting on the corner of Wall and Fraud. Enron was a public company. In fact, at the time of its December 2001 bankruptcy filing, the seventh largest one in the United States. Today, that five-letter word, Enron, has grown to represent much more than it ever was or could have been as a thriving, forward-looking, new economy dynamo. What ultimately brought Enron down was greed, a greed only rivaled by a street that Enron sought to emulate, Wall Street. In fact, Enron's famed energy trading operations were nothing more than a Wall Street trading floor on steroids. By the time of its fall, it was no longer a company dependent on hard assets, but one dangerously dependent upon sophisticated and arcane financial instruments designed to deceive and enrich only a handful of chosen executives. Sharon Watkins was not one of the chosen. An accountant by training, she migrated, as did many, from the now defunct Arthur Andersen to Enron in 1993. Enron was the destination of choice for those wanting to ride a financial juggernaut. Sharon Watkins played the Enron game until the violations of accounting principles and law became too much for her to bear. Her now infamous memo she gave to Chairman and CEO Ken Lay, in which she presciently predicted, quote, "I am incredibly nervous that we will implode in a wave of accounting scandals," close quote, set off the beginning of the end for Enron. She is known as the Enron whistleblower and has been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year 2002 and co-author of the new book, Power Failure, The Inside Story of the Collapse of Enron. Sharon Watkins, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sharon, let's start off simple. What exactly was Enron?
Well, Enron began its life in 1985 as the merger of two very large regulated gas pipeline companies. The combination of the two companies made Enron the largest regulated gas pipeline company in North America.
Okay. And you were an accountant by trade. You were with Arthur Andersen. And you moved over to Enron in 93. Now, prior to that, though, with Arthur Andersen, you were based in New York City, weren't you?
Well, I started out in Houston, in Texas, where I'm from. But in 1987, I transferred to the New York office.
And how long were you in the Big Apple?
6 years.
And you liked it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Perfect years. I was 28 to 34.
Right. And you wanted to, as many people did, wanted to go back to Houston and join Enron. And what was the main reason for that?
Well, by then, Enron had already really morphed itself into a new company. It had started gas trading in 1990, and by 1993 had built a reputation as almost the Wall Street of Texas, except for energy trading. It was the place to be for oil and gas finance, for gas trading. They were talking up getting into power trading. It was known as an innovative company, you know, as early as 93, and heading back to Houston, it just felt like it was the only place to try to land a job.
Right, and it was all right in the beginning?
Oh, yes, it really was. Enron hired sharp, ambitious people, and I remember Andy Fastow even telling me once.
And he was the chief financial officer.
He hired me then. He was in charge of the off-balance sheet investment vehicles for Enron.
Right.
He was not yet CFO. But he mentioned that, you know, this place could turn nasty if the pie ever stops growing. But with the pie growing and all of us able to carve enough out for ourselves, everything seems okay. But Enron really was hiring very, very aggressive, ambitious types.
Mostly young males.
Yes.
Under the age of 30.
Certainly in the trading shops, yes.
Right, okay. Now, everybody pretty much remembers and knows about Enron's story. There have been movies made about it. Of course, there was a TV movie, I think it was called The Crooked E, and you were highlighted in there. There have been several books about Enron, but the book that you're involved in now, Power Failure, The Inside Story of the Collapse of Enron, is the only book about Enron from an insider's point of view. Is that correct?
That is of this nature and scope. There was a hurry-up book done by, I call him the kid. He had been at the company only 9 months, and his book, Anatomy of Greed, was really just his account of what happened his 9 months while he was there, plus sort of all the newspaper accounts of Enron's demise.
Okay, now, of course, Enron was formed by what is it, InterNorth and Houston Natural Gas?
Yes.
And that was put together by Ken Lay.
Yes.
Right, and Ken Lay was, early on in his career, involved in politics. He was an assistant to the Undersecretary of the Navy, is that correct?
Yes, that and other positions with what is now known as the FERC. So he was a big proponent of gas deregulation.
Right. One of the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we talked a little bit over the weekend about how Enron got so out of control. And I mentioned Wall Street. I said, do you think Wall Street, the pressure applied by Wall Street was apparent? And you said huge. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the company had... Even in 93, it really promised to deliver 15% earnings growth a year. Now, that sounds a little crazy when you think about it, but it had continued to do that by, you know, starting new business lines like gas trading. And that became something that was the be-all and end-all. You know, you were going to meet those earnings targets no matter what.
Right.
And that has proven to be the downfall of other companies as well. I mean, you start to put a little fudge in the numbers, and it doesn't take too long before you know, you're moving towards not just aggressive accounting, but potentially fraudulent accounting.
And you think there are a lot more Enrons out there?
I'm afraid so. Look at HealthSouth, the recent scandal, and Scrocci, the CEO of that company, sounds like a combination Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling.
Right. Right. And where are they now? I mean, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling, are they still traipsing around Houston?
They certainly are. Much of the civil litigation has been stayed while the Department of Justice pursues criminal charges. The Department of Justice has formed what they call an Enron task force that is really unprecedented in scope, considering it's just for one company. Some of the prosecutors and FBI agents have actually moved to Houston because they expect it take about 5 years.
So they've actually relocated to Houston.
Yes.
5 years. So this is supposed to take half a decade in order to get these guys. And you're pretty confident that they'll be brought to justice.
I think so. I mean, Skilling's going to be tricky because he really kept his fingerprints off so much of this. But, you know, Skilling and Lay and Scrocci at HealthSouth, I mean, they all claim that they weren't aware of the details. But you know, it's just like some mafia boss saying, you know, I didn't order someone whacked. I mean, that just because, you know, you're still setting the tone at the top. They knew what was happening, and they have to turn over the middle level managers to really provide testimony on the higher ups. But that's the route they're taking.
Right. Has anyone been sentenced yet?
Well, they have two guilty pleas on the financial accounting problems. Two guilty pleas in California trading, and they've indicted three people on the financial side with more expected. People expect at least maybe 25 felons associated with Enron when it's all said and done.
25?
Mm-hmm.
And you think Ken Lay will be one of them?
I don't know. I do not know. Under the new Sarbanes-Oxley Act, he would be. But since Enron happened before that act was passed, I think he might not be.
And, of course, he was a huge campaign contributor.
Yes, and that's, I think, one of the main problems. He was CEO for far too long. He became focused on Republican Party endeavors as early as 1992 and really was not focused on running the company.
Right. Well, I think in the book it mentioned that he was well aware of how important it was for a company to become associated and affiliated with Washington, D.C.
Yes, the company gave almost 50-50 to both parties. But Lay himself
Smart.
Was a big supporter of the Republican Party, but he was playing golf with Bill Clinton about 6 to 9 months after Clinton took office. So he played both sides of the fence.
Right, and of course he was hoping that George Bush, number 41, would have gotten in because he really laid the groundwork for Enron to move forward a lot more than it could have and did under Clinton.
Well, and he was pushing for a power deregulation across the country in different states, but the big brouhaha right now is derivatives trading and how that is an unregulated industry and it's hard to assess the risk. And Enron was one of the biggest companies that pushed for that class of transactions to be outside the purview of regulators.
Right, and of course, former Senator Phil Graham's wife, Wendy Graham, was on Enron's board, right?
Yes, and she was former chairman of the Commodities Futures Exchange.
It's funny how that works out, you know? I can't figure that out. It was pretty tough for you there, tough going when you did go to Ken Lay with that memo, and you thought that Lay was, as you said, a man of integrity and that he would try to straighten the company out. A lot of people believe that Ken Lay was just a dupe for Jeff Skilling, but as it turned out, it didn't work out that way, and you were demoted, is that right? And you were moved down a couple of floors?
Yes, I mean, every stereotypical action about whistleblowing happened where I was in a cruddy little office with no real work to do, treated like a pariah. But the fall of 2001, I mean, I expected so many different things to happen. Jeff Skilling had abruptly resigned. Ken Lay was stepping back in as CEO. I thought Skilling's action of resigning plus my memo ought to be enough evidence that something was horribly wrong.
Right.
With the company, but Lay instead chose to stick his head in the sand, and they hired Enron's primary outside counsel, Vinson and Elkins, to look into my concerns. But they were limited in scope. They were not supposed to look into the accounting. They were supposed to look into whether I was bringing up anything new, which is almost a bizarre way of saying she's accusing us of robbing the bank, but, you know, is that new information? Didn't we know we were robbing the bank? They ended up producing what I call a whitewash report in mid-October, and Enron, it was quite disturbing to me because I just thought this big money buy off everyone. You know, Anderson had succumbed, Vinson and Elkins was also capitulating, and it was quite worrisome.
Right, and it seemed like it did, and it does. Now, after you left Enron, you were going through some of your old cartons and maybe banker's boxes filled with stuff, and you came across a telephone notepad quote, one of those telephone notepads that I guess they have the date and they have a quote of a famous person. And you said that there were a couple of keywords to Enron's mission statement. What were they?
Well, Enron's values were respect, integrity, communication, and excellence. And they handed out notepads with each one of the values described. And on the communication notepad was a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. that said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter.
And why was that significant to you?
Well, it just almost floored me that, you know, everyone had these notepads on their desk.
Right.
Yet so many people at Enron were silent about this accounting fraud.
Right. Except for you. And, of course, when you did finally speak up and everything came crashing down, Time magazine named you the person of the year along with a couple of other whistleblowers. How did that affect you, and how has that changed your life?
Well, it was an unbelievable honor.
Right.
I think they called 2002 the year of the whistleblower.
Right.
But it also, you know, puts you a little bit on a pedestal and makes you feel a little uncomfortable. About having a bullseye on your back and now it's time to knock you off, but B, almost living up to the honor. You know, it's what am I going to do with the next 20 years of my life?
It's a tough act to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as you said, there were only a few women prior to you who have been the person of the year.
I think that was their 76th year, and there have just been six covers that were women. In fact, the magazine still, I think, most of the staffers still refer to it as the Man of the Year issue.
Right. That's pretty incredible. Sharon, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, your book, Power Failure, The Inside Story of the Collapse of Enron, by Mimi Schwartz, or Swartz, with Sharon Watkins. You can go to my website and WallStreetJovial.com and check it out there. If you've missed any portion of this program, you can go to WallAndFraud.com, where an audio file of this interview will be available in a few hours, and any and all emails are welcome. Sharon Watkins, good luck with the book. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Look forward to talking to you in the future.
Okay, great.
Take care.